Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, this is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. My guests tonight are Angelique Fawcett and her husband, Stephen L. Fawcett. It's going to take me a minute to dial because things have been happening here, so just bear with me while I dial her, well, their phone number, and then we will be talking to them shortly, and it's not allowing me to dial. Oh, this is wonderful. Isn't this great? thank you for staying with me, if you're staying with me, and hopefully here we go. I've been having trouble with Blog Talk Radio trying to get in, so I'm not sure what's going to happen. At least it's dialing.
Hello.
Hello, Angelique.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, yeah. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, just peachy keen.
That's good. I have Steve here with me. You want to say hi, Steve?
Hello. How are you?
Hello, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing well. How is everything in New York?
Oh, you know, SSDD, like I like to say. How are the little fur babies?
They're doing good. We just came back from a walk, so they're happy about that. Lola's sitting right here, and Augie, I think, is trying to go outside. We might have to let him in and out because he likes to go in and out. You know, he's new.
Aw. Well, yeah, that's a dog for you. They want to go in and out.
Yes.
So one of the things that I wanted to ask you guys, might as well just go into it, I guess. Whoever wants to talk first doesn't matter to me, but I was wanting you to let the listeners know, how and when did you guys meet and fall in love and then get married? Whoever wants to go first.
We talk together, but like, you want to start?
Yeah, you
can start.
How we met was
Lola wants to get up.
We met actually on a at an audition for our movie Unbelievable, and Angelique was doing a favor for the casting director. And she was reading the sides for all the ladies that were coming in to compete for a role. I think we had 100 people there that day.
Yeah, the person who got that role was Katarina Vanderham, and I had just left the finance industry, and so I was just doing this favor for a friend by reading. But go ahead, Steve. Sorry.
So anyway, she was sitting next to me the whole day was we were, and she was just reading the sides over and over and over again. And I said, you know, are you doing okay? And she said, yeah, I'm just, you know, here doing a favor for a friend. And I was like, oh, okay. And so a couple of days later, we met in Santa Monica. And I think maybe we thought it was going to be a, you know, 10, 15 minute talk. It ended up being 3 hours. And we just clicked, you know, and her birthday and my birthday are almost identical. I'm April 13th, she's April 15th. And so we decided that we would get married on April 14th between our birthdays. And we got married at the Venetian in Las Vegas, and Michelle Nichols, it was at her suggestion. She said that she was going to give Angelique away to me at our wedding. So she did.
And she told him he better not mess up because she knows where he lives. So she's a sweetheart. It was just so nice of her because we were just having a small wedding. We didn't want a big wedding. Both of us had been married twice before, and we didn't want some big to do. And we just had a few friends, and you know, she was just like, "Nope, I'm giving you away, and I'm going to come there." So it was just really sweet. She came all the way from LA to Las Vegas to be with us, and she was there with our rehearsal dinner. She's just, you know who she is to us, and how much we love her.
Aww. Yeah, she is a real sweetheart. I love her.
Yeah.
So that was 7 years ago, and I don't know that we've had the 7-year itch yet, but maybe we've had it and it's gone.
Yeah, 7 years ago. But we met 8 years ago. 8 years ago.
Yeah, eight years ago, but we've been married 7.
Yeah.
Aww. Yeah, it seems like you guys are, you know, I'm talking about somebody looking from the outside. It seems like you guys are very happy. I mean, and every time I see any pictures of you, you look at each other with love, and you can see that in the pictures. And you find that amusing?
We do not take ourselves very seriously.
We don't. And like, you know, I mean, we're married, but it's normal. It's like, you know, we fight and we don't fight, and we click extremely well. It's, I think, has something to do with, you know, we are the same sun sign. We're the same sign. So we have the same way of thinking. If something is going to work, it's going to be really great. And we're like, oh, yes, we're going to do it. And we're just focused, laser focused on that. We get it done. And if something's not working, we usually both agree on it. And we're like, forget that noise. And we step away from it. But, you know, being married and working together is also a challenge. It's a challenge because there's times when, you know, certain people come in that are, you know, weird, or, you know, their intentions aren't right. Then we have to deal with that. And if it's one of our friends, you know, we have to deal with that. So it's kind of, you know, there's tough times. It's not like super easy, like, you know, I don't know, Disney or something like that. But I guess we make it work, you know.
Oh, well, no marriage is easy. I mean, a good marriage. No good marriage is easy. And, you know, when I said that about the, you know, the love thing, I just meant that as, well, as you know, as a compliment. Because some pictures you see of people that are married, they look like they don't want to be anywhere near that person.
I know. Thank you. We took it as a compliment. And Augie has joined us as well. So, you know, both dogs are here during the interview. So.
Hello, Augie and Lola. They're such cute dogs. Okay, so I did want to ask Stephen particularly about being an award-winning novelist. So tell us about, you know, just like a short synopsis, because it's like I actually gave you guys an hour and a half instead of an hour, so we don't have to get cut off by Blog Talk Radio at an hour. But give us like a short synopsis of each one of the books and tell us what it's like to be an award winner.
I, to be honest with you, I didn't even know I had won an award.
Until he knew.
somebody called me and said, oh, did you see your name up in on this announcement? I said, no, what? And they said, well, you were, your book was selected as the best action adventure novel of the year by the Booksellers Association. And I was like, well, okay. They didn't bother to tell me, so I didn't know. I mean, you know, it was one of those phantom awards. I don't know, but apparently that's what happened. It was back in 2006, and I wrote a book, very kind of political intrigue, apocalyptic, sci-fi, almost spiritual type book, called The Archangels of Dreamland. And it came out in, as I said, in 2006. The reason why we call our film company Archangel Films is because of of the book that I wrote, Archangels of Dreamland, and I do intend to turn it into a major motion picture here fairly soon. I guess as soon as we can raise the money for it. But it's about the Roswell incident back in 1947, and how the U.S. government reverse engineered the computer on board and ended up changing the course of history. And it's just high action, apocalyptic stuff. It's it's essentially the story of a woman who witnessed the Roswell incident. She was a young girl out on a date, and the government showed up, and she had to run into hiding, and she left Roswell and went to Juarez, Mexico, to get away from the federal agents. And she became the Mother Superior of the convent there, and every 7 years, miraculously, she starts having babies. And these babies are different races, and the Catholic Church knows about this, and they're treating it completely under the table. They don't know, they don't want anyone to know about her. And it's been a kind of a miracle type situation, and several popes have visited her over the years and that sort of thing. Well, anyway, a jealous nun decides to expose her because she thinks that this madre is obviously having sex for these babies, and obviously she's not, but she thinks she is. And so she reports it to the press, and then the press runs with the story, and then all of her offspring that she's had over the years, have been adopted and have gone on to lead other lives, now they're being targeted by assassins from the U.S. government, because they don't want this knowledge getting out, because they don't even know what these people are. I mean, they're essentially hybrid humans, and so the mother and all of the kids survive the assassination attempts, and they all get together, and then there are some just huge apocalyptic events. A huge earthquake occurs in Las Vegas and destroys the city, and 300-foot tidal waves at the Hoover Dam, and all sorts of crazy big sudden events occur. And
he writes it, and it's written in real high action. I guess that's probably why he won that award, because it feels like you're watching a movie when you're reading the books.
So
anyway,
I was actually living in Denver at the time, and the second book, Archangels 2, is just a continuation, a direct continuation of the first book. And I was contacted by a lawyer friend of mine at the time, and he said, Warner Brothers wants to buy the rights to your novel. And I said, okay. So I came out to Hollywood, and we sat there, and they made me an offer, which was a very generous offer. It was a high six-figure offer. And I said, well, can I have anything to do with the making of the film? And they said, absolutely not. You're going to take this money. You're gone. We never want to see you again. And I said, well, then I guess I'm not going to be able to sell my rights. And so I held on to the rights. And so I said, I'm going to just start making movies. That's what I've always wanted to do anyway. So, at an advanced age of, I don't know what I was at that time, 55 or something.
Yeah.
I said, okay, I'm going to do this little script that I had written back in college, back at the University of Miami, where I went to college.
and it was called Unbelievable. And so I decided I would just, you know, I put like a couple of hundred thousand together of my own money and go in and just shoot it. And a producer told me, he says, no, you can't do that. You've got to have people that people have heard of in order to get any kind of money out of it. So I started inching the budget up, and then it went higher and higher and higher. And so it ended up being $4 million, which we raised, both Angelique and myself. And we had all these actors, these Star Trek actors, they all started coming on board, and one after the other. And, you know, they all know each other from, you know, the conventions. And that was kind of how it all came to be.
Wow. That's all very interesting. And your books, tell people where they can buy them at.
Well, they're available on Amazon. You know, I think that's pretty much the go-to place where people can get them. It's called Archangels of Dreamland and Archangels II, the Grigori. The Grigori are the essentially the minions of Satan. And they are the angels of Satan, if you will. And it's a little bit spiritual, but it's not religious, if you get the difference. There's no dogma. There's no, you know, I'm not trying to proselytize or make anyone want to believe something that they don't necessarily want to believe. It's just all for entertainment value.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. But they're both, you know, high action, high adventure stuff, and probably more than likely we'll shoot both movies at the same time.
Cool.
since they are, one directly follows the other. It's literally 10 minutes after the last one ends is when the second one begins. So it would make sense for us to just go ahead and shoot both at the same time.
Hmm. Cool. Yeah, that does make sense to me anyway. Angelique, I know that you're an elder abuse activist. Obviously, I know about that. So tell us how that came about, if you even realize how it came about. I mean, other than you're a caring person anyway, I already know that. But if there was a specific thing that, like, triggered you to specifically go into being an elder abuse activist.
Yeah, it elder abuse activism, I don't think that, you know, you don't choose it. I say this on my website as I was just pondering through things. You don't choose it. It chooses you. And
mm-hmm.
as you know, I produced Unbelievable. Steve and I personally cast every single actor and actress. There were only a few that we didn't personally cast. We met through other people, but very few. And Nichelle became a very, very good friend of mine, Nichelle Nichols, and became like a mother to me. And I didn't need another mother, but she definitely came in and stole my heart. And I saw her go through, both Steve and I saw her go through some really terrible things from various people. In the media, you can see that they're stating that the manager has done certain things. I watched a lot happen. I reported a lot to the family to tell them, look, this is what's going on. But yet and still, the main family member that should have been around wasn't for 6 years, refused to come around. And when she was going through some pretty terrible stuff that her fans didn't know about because it wasn't publicized, you know, it wasn't something that was out in the news, she was placed in a rest home. And she didn't want to be in that rest home, but her son wanted to keep her in that rest home. She escaped that rest home, and she said to protect her. So She asked me to make a video of her stating what she wanted in her final years. She asked me to handle some other paperwork for her and asked me, the one thing she asked me to do is just stand up for her. That's it. And I'm like, well, that's not hard. You're my friend. I care about you. That's pretty easy. And all that she gave to me and to Steve with moral support and love and just constantly in our lives and loving our work, coming on set, being there for us. I think that, you know, I could, you know, definitely give back to my friends. And plus, I don't make promises that I don't keep. And unfortunately, through all of her elder abuse, no matter which direction it was coming from, I ultimately ended up going to court and standing up for her on my own dime to preserve her human rights and civil rights. All she wanted to do is stay in her home, work, visit her fans. A lot of fans don't know right now she's no longer in her home. I fought for her for 2.5 years, and I'm still quite upset about it. I'm very upset about the fact that you can be an elder, you can state exactly what you want, and people take it as, oh, well, that was years ago. You know, that doesn't apply to now. Yes, it does. People are actually trying to protect themselves back then so they can be prepared for right now.
Right.
And so becoming an elder abuse activist is not something that I chose or even that I wanted, but I love my friend. She has treated me like I have been a daughter to her. We are not blood. But sometimes you have those spiritual connections and they're there and you nurture them and take care of them. I still fight for Nichelle. I will still continue to fight for Nichelle. I don't care what people say. I don't care what people think. I'm just going to do what Nichelle asked me to do. And that's exactly what I've done. And I continue to do because, again, I kept a promise. I worry about her. I'm very concerned about her well-being. And again, you just have to continue to fight. These kind of things just happen. Every person that I know that has become an elder abusive activist, it's not because they thought, oh, let me go out and become an elder abuse activist. No, you don't do that. Usually it's some family member or friend, they go through something terrible and you're the one to stand up for them. As I stood up for Nichelle, it's good to say that Kasem Cares actually came to my side. Steve actually found Kasem Cares, and Carrie Kasem is Casey Kasem's daughter, and her father suffered terrible, terrible elder abuse, and she ended up creating a 501c3 to help others not go through what she went through, which is called Kasem Cares. They helped me find a lawyer. They went to court with me, and then it just became a network of people. You know, a lot of us went to court, you know, with each other or for each other, so the other person didn't have to be alone, because it's tremendously challenging to fight for an elder when most of the elder abuse probate courts are extremely corrupt. And I do mean corrupt. And I don't mind saying it. I will tell you right now, the judge that oversaw Nichelle Nichols' probate case was corrupt. And I don't have a problem saying it, because it's the damn truth. If she wasn't, Nichelle would still be in the house that she worked hard for. And I'll say this about actresses, producers, actors, directors, people that people say is celebrity. Okay, to me, like celebrity, okay, it's just a word. Because in the end, we're all human beings. Yep. We all go to work. It doesn't matter if you go to work at Home Depot and your office is the stockroom. It doesn't matter if you go to some executive position or some management position. You got your office or cubicle. That's work. That's your office. If you're an actor or an actress, your set is your office. She worked hard going in and out of the office each time she was on set and worked hard for her money to be able to afford the property that she lived on. And to afford the little things that she had, things that made her happy. She had a beautiful garden and property. That's all she asked. Is just, can I stay here? Can I pass here one day? So she hasn't gotten that wish. And it's really just very saddening. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure many people have seen, you know, the abuse tape. It's not an ambush. I don't have any... what do you call it, favoritism for any of the abusers. I don't think that anyone in this situation, you know, did her right. So, like I said, I just have to continue to fight and hope that I can somehow preserve some of those rights, because she deserves to get what any of us would get if we tried hard enough to make sure that we had certain things in our last days. It is human. It is our human right. It is our civil right to get what we ask for, you know, no matter, you know, where you're at. So I could go on for hours, but I'm not going to, because it's pretty
intense. Yeah, I, you know, when somebody works for something that's theirs, I mean, it would be no different, because I've explained it to people myself when they talk about, oh, well, you know, they're just doing what's best for the person. Well, no, not necessarily, because you got to look at the whole picture, not just as what you think is going on, which is, oh, well, they're trying to help them. Not always, and I know from having experienced that in my own family, that, you know, in distant family, but they weren't working for the benefit of their parent, who was my uncle. They were working towards getting him committed so that they could take his property. That's what they wanted.
Yes.
So I understand totally this whole thing. And now, I'm not as well acquainted with Nichelle as you are, but I do know her, and she's been very good to me over the years, just a few times that I've talked to her. And so she's really, like, close in my heart. It's not the same as you, obviously, but she's very close for different reasons to my heart.
Yes, and I understand
so it really
that.
Bothers me.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
She is the sweetest actress I've ever met in my life. And I have family members who are, you know, in entertainment. And she actually, you know, stops and talks to every fan, greets every fan, takes pictures, people, you know, no problem. Because she truly loves from her heart. And shouldn't someone who truly loves from their heart be loved, right? They shouldn't be manhandled.
Yeah.
Once you say, get your hands off of me, that means get your hands off of me. If that was in a domestic violence situation, what would someone say? Oh, you know, that's all right. He put your hands on you, or she put her hands on you. No, somebody's getting arrested. So, yes, it's terrible, and I understand her specialness to you, too. She had that impact on everybody. She really, really does, and she deserves the best. She doesn't deserve what somebody else chooses for her. You know,
right.
she has some memory loss. I don't know how she is right now, because I don't know where she is right now. I know what state she's in, but you know, this is not how you should treat people in this situation, especially when they've asked for certain things ahead of time. It's just not the way it should be.
No, yeah. Because I've written her snail mail letters that get returned, so I have no idea where she is either. But yeah,
well,
if anybody would know, I would think it would be you. You know, not me. But yeah, and if you don't know, I certainly don't know.
No, I know she's in New Mexico, but you know, I have to deal with a corrupt court. I'll tell you,
right.
Look. I went to, Carrie Kasem called me one day, just like, called me out of the blue. She's like, Angelique, you know, our friend is over in court, you know, today. Can you come out and support us, right? So I go to court, and Kelly Rooney, who is Mickey Rooney's daughter, is fighting in probate court for her father, who had already passed. And you want to know all she was doing? She wasn't looking for money. Just like me, I don't need anything, don't want anything. I just want Nichelle's safety and her human rights preserved.
Right.
Kelly Rooney was just fighting for Mickey Rooney's, one of his Oscars, to be put in a museum instead of being sold on the black market. She's just trying to preserve her father's legacy.
Yeah.
The judge knocked her down. There was an attorney there. And we all ganged up on the attorney. We're like, you need to put yourself in this situation. What if this was your father? why are you being so harsh? He was beating up on her in court, not physically, but beating up on her metaphorically. Oh, you know, she's done this, she's done that. It was ridiculous. And that's what they do to people who stand up, you know, and they don't care about the person, whether alive or deceased. So, yeah. Again, I could go out for hours. Cheryl, you don't want to hear me. You don't want to hear me because it makes me too upset. And people don't always do it right.
Yeah, and obviously I don't want you to get upset. And once you start talking about it, the more you talk about it, the more upset you get. So, yeah, we'll stop talking about it now. But it is an important subject. And I thank you for talking about it for the listeners, and hopefully some of them will, you know, take your lead in what you do. So now we'll move on. So getting to Unbelievable, which you both have mentioned. Now, you wrote the script, correct, Stephen?
Yes, I wrote the script back in 1977.
Ah,
which,
wow,
that's when pterodactyls were flying.
I was barely born. I was seven.
Well, I'm 17, so.
So I wrote that I had a creative writing course at the college, and that was kind of like my end product from the class in college, and I just, you know, it was supposed to be written. It was actually written 3 years before the Zucker brothers did Airplane. But it's very similar to Airplane, very similar to that style. Airplane, Naked Gun, Mars Attacks. It's very similar to that kind of thing. And it was about these four astronauts that have to go up to a lunar base because they lost contact with these two other astronauts up at the lunar base. And they find out that those two are not whom they appear to be. They've turned into aliens, and we find out that we are the human race is now being invaded by plant aliens from Mars, and so the four astronauts decide to figure out how to rid the Earth of all these plant aliens, and so. I was a fan of Star Trek when it first came out. I was 10 years old in 1966, and I fell in love with it. It was different. It was interesting. It was something that just wasn't on any other show on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly I was right because it stood the test of time. They're still making Star Trek, TV shows and movies as we speak.
Right.
But for whatever reason, it didn't occur to me that this could have been a parody, a Star Trek parody. It was a parody, but I was just playing it, you know, kind of like straight, and it didn't really have a Star Trek connection. It only gained a Star Trek connection as I was taking it around town. I was seeing what actors I could get to be in it, and the first actor that actually read it was Michael Dorn, who played Worf. And he read it, and then he called back, and he said, "Is this for real? I mean, is this serious?" And I said, no. I said, not a thing in here is supposed to be serious. It's all just a gag.
No, we think he got probably got
and,
so many serious scripts. He
yeah,
thought we were
he
being
said,
serious.
Yeah, he says, well, at Paramount, they hardly ever allow us to do anything comedic. And so he says, oh, I get it. Oh, okay. And so he said, yeah, I'll do this. And then he said, you know, if you'd like, I could contact Marina Sirtis. She's a friend of mine. And you know, and so it kind of developed like that. And so I remember we were at lunch at the time I got the call. And I said, you know, this may be the best way to go. And I said, we need to hire as many Star Trek actors as we can get our hands on. And let's just make this a kind of a mad, mad world of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And we went to the conventions and you know, they're all sitting there and they're all, you know, there's, you know, sometimes they're just waiting around for someone to come and take a picture with them or whatever. And we approached them, Angelique and myself, and we said, you know, this is what we're planning to do, and gave them a copy of the script, and they got back to us and they said, yeah, you know, we'll do this. And so after a while, we started getting calls from other actors that we hadn't even approached, saying, can we get in on this? Can you write me a scene? And one of the stars of the movie is actually a puppet, a marionette.
I know.
She sees all of my posts on Facebook,
and,
so she sees all.
Yeah,
well, she sees the puppet and
the
horse.
This was something that kind of came out of necessity in a way, because I thought about Captain Kirk and you know, I said, well, you know, maybe we could have a kind of a Captain Kirk character leading this bunch. And so I didn't really know exactly how to emulate the look of the 60s Kirk. And then I started thinking about Thunderbirds and Team America World Police. And I said, you know, maybe we could do this as a marionette. And all these people are talking and answering to this marionette like he's for real, like he's a real human. I said, that's part of the gag, you know, that. So we went to the Kyoto brothers, who designed all the marionettes for Team America.
Those guys are crazy. They're wonderful, but crazy.
Yeah. And so they had about three or four bodies left over from the original movie that they did for Paramount. And I said, could you take one of those and make them look like 60s Kirk? And they said, yeah, I think we could do that. And so they went on doing it, and they got his little hair and his little teeth.
They would send us pictures. Like, it's almost like having a baby or something. They're like, okay, his teeth are in now. And his little bald head, they have little, you know, putting the hair in, and it was crazy. And because he had a skeleton head at first, you know, but it was interesting experience with
and,
all those guys.
I remember running the idea past Michelle.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, what do you think about that? And she laughed for 20 minutes. And she said, oh, that's going to be very funny. And
she loved it, yeah.
So, yeah, so we went ahead and it cost us $22,000 for that puppet, but it was the best $22,000 we probably spent on the entire film. And
I need to tell her about the puppet, so you know, he actually had a whole glam team, because that skin that's on him is this really soft material, and they actually had to, you know, take the makeup off, reapply the makeup on him. There's pictures of him with curlers in his hair. And, you know, he had the whole setup. He had the whole setup.
So anyway, we didn't know quite what we were going to do, you know, with the voice for a while. And then one of the puppeteers, Kevin Carlson, was actually pretty good at mimicking, you know, the old Shatner voice. And so we went with it. And we owe Kevin a lot, because he really ad-libbed a lot of this. And it made it a lot funnier than what it would have been without it. And so he is a real crazy man. He really is.
And a lot of those puppeteers, they worked on Jabba the Hutt, Yoda, some of the most famous puppeteering in the world. So it was really an honor to have them, because, you know, they just kept working with us and we were really grateful, but they knew what they were doing. They really did.
Yeah. So anyway, we put it all together, and it was difficult for us in a way, because a lot of these Star Trek actors aren't available in L.A. Whenever you just need them. They're going to conventions like every week, you know. This was pre-COVID, obviously. And so they go to these conventions, and then, you know, we would have to wait for all of them, you know, or the ones that we needed to be in town at the same time. So we had to kind of crew up and crew down all the time. So it took us several years, I guess like three years to get the main principal photography done. 2013, we had a few scenes in 2014 and a few in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
But we put it all together, and you know, we took it out to a couple of the conventions to let some of the fans see it.
Mm-hmm.
And they love the interaction of the old Star Trek actors, but they weren't exactly crazy about who we had in the lead, the lead bad guy at that time. And so we started to rethink that, and we said, you know, who would be the best leader of the plant aliens, the people that are running the plants? And so we thought of Snoop Dogg, and we said, you know, I mean, he's obviously known being a marijuana enthusiast, and it kind of almost made sense to us in a way, because, you know, he's there's just so many. It's really kind of almost like a stoner film in a way. And it just kind of clicked. Well, what we didn't know was that Snoop Dogg is a major Star Trek fan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that we were kind of floored about. We walked into his offices in Inglewood, and there's this huge mural on the wall. And there's Kirk and Spock and Uhura, and there's the Starship Enterprise. And I'm like, what the hell? I mean, did he do this for us? You know, I can't imagine he would have. And all of his rooms, they had several rooms, and they were all named Starship, Battleship, Mothership. And so we go into his main enclave, and it's in the shape of the bridge of the Enterprise.
Cool.
Along with the captain's chair right in the center, and all the different, you know, screens around, and he uses it so that he can watch his football games on the weekend. And, it was wild. I remember saying, the first thing out of my mouth was, I said, wow, you really are a Star Trek fan. So, that was kind of how we met, and he agreed to do it. I think Nichelle wanted him to do this, and so we got him, we signed him, and we put him into the film. It was I guess it was about four or five scenes that we had to that we ended up reshooting, and but we added things. We added a lot of other Star Trek Easter eggs. And one was the Guardian of Forever. We called it the Gardener of Frickin' Forever. And we got Robert Davi to do the voice of that. And he played it like a kind of a New York wise guy type of role. And we had Cribbles instead of Tribbles. And then we had a horse. We decided that the horse was playing my idea of Baylock. Baylock from one of the original. And instead of Baylock, we called him Buttock. And so the little horse is Snoop Dogg's sidekick. And so that's kind of how it all came to be.
And you did the voice for that Buttock, right? Buttock Snorts?
Yeah, I really, really, and Angelique will attest to this, I really tried to get someone else to do it. I wanted Arnold Schwarzenegger to do it. And I went to great lengths to try and get him, but I just wasn't able to pull that off. I think it just got to a point where I just said, you know, let's just roll with it. And so I had done it, and I think Angelique thought it was funny with what I had done. So we decided to keep it in.
Well, Angelique, you were also in the film acting. Tell us about your roles.
I played quite a few. I played Lynn Hastings. My co-star was Manu Antirayemi. And then I actually was the voice of the Cribbles, Nene and Tete. And it's just because, you know, when you're an independent filmmaker, you get to a point where, okay, you've raised $4 million and, you know, you can't afford to keep paying for additional actors. It would have been wonderful if we got Arnold Schwarzenegger. We would have raised the money for him if necessary.
Yeah.
But there's certain roles I played just out of necessity. I don't usually tell people this, but I'll tell you, as I was in the body of the Gorn, opposite Bobby Clark, who actually played the Gorn. And the Arena was one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek in totality. So that was kind of a really neat thing to do. And it was such a special day for Bobby for many reasons as well. So what else did I play? Oh, I played Afro Agent with Michael Madsen.
Over Nursery.
Oh, and Nursery with Snoop Dogg and Michelle. I think that's all I did. Oh, I was a cow too. I was Milkshake the cow. So, that was our scene together. Steve and I scene together. The only scene we've ever had together is he
up
played.
Up in Uranus.
Oh my God! You see what I have to deal with? Okay. So there's the horse. He's the horse, and I'm the cow, and we're just talking, and you know, it's fun. It's special things for us, but you know, no one else probably cares or knows that. Yeah, it was fun. It was interesting experience, you know, producing and acting. It's at the same time, it's doable. You just have to compartmentalize. You know, when you are producing, you're producing, and when you're acting. Usually what I would do is, if I was doing both in one day, I had an alternate, and I said, please, if you can handle everything while I'm acting, and if you can ask everyone not to ask me things while I'm acting, then that would be great. And that all worked out. So I just did my work, my acting work, and then went back to producing when I was finished acting on set that day. So it worked out. Everything's doable.
Cool. Yeah, so many people have been talking about this film, you know, well, actually for several years, because it's been a kind of long journey for the both of you, getting this film made. And I know that it's been like I know it's cliche, but a labor of love for you to get this film. And now people are being able to see it. And so let people know where they can rent it or buy it or, you know, however that they can watch this film.
Okay, well, the film just got released on cable TV just the other day on, I believe it was Monday. So on demand, it's on Spectrum, Comcast, Vudu, which is a streaming service, that's V-U-D-U. It's still on Amazon. We're told that it's on Dish Networks and Cox, but we haven't seen it pop up yet. So, but that's part of it. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yes. It was just something that I guess the system said. But it's supposed to also be on Dish Networks and Cox, but we haven't seen it popped up yet. So until we do, I haven't advertised that on our Facebook page yet because until I see it, I want to put it up there. You know, I want to make sure that the people who have been waiting to see this film can actually see it where it's available. But it's still available on Amazon, too, if people just have Amazon and don't have cable TV. But we were very happy to get it onto cable. That was something that Steve really, really pushed. And he pushed hard, and he won. So I'm really glad about that. And, you know, it took us a long time to do this film because both of us came from corporate America. And, you know, although I grew up in the industry, I wasn't necessarily always in the industry. I was kind of in and out. And, you know, we weren't, you know, quote unquote, as people say, big wigs, nor do I ever want to be a big wig. I like being a human being and just getting my work done, right? But you do have to know people in the industry to get certain things done. And so sometimes we would have to wait until we got all four actors, including the puppeteers and the other three actors together in the same place at the same time. That would take months. And then, you know, getting all of the actors together and then screening it and seeing who's right for it. And then when we got Snoop Dogg, that was a really wonderful thing because he was so perfect for it, like Steve said. So it was really just a connective thing. And although it's painful that it takes so long, it's also going to be something I think that people will enjoy seeing for a long time. And we have so many stories. There is so much trivia behind this entire, you know, creation, which is really neat to share. But I hope that all filmmakers know, even from just seeing our film or any film that independent filmmakers have worked hard on, that it's totally possible. I mean, you can push a film and believe in it. And as long as you believe in it, you know, keep your promise to people who put money into it, into the actors and the crew, you know, and push it all the way to from Amazon to cable TV. You know, theaters don't really exist anymore, not in the manner in which we used to do. But
right.
If people see that it can happen, that they will continue to pursue their own goals of wherever they want their films to be placed, you know. So we have a lot to share about this film. There's just so much stuff we learned. And
well, one thing that we would probably like to share with you is the quest that we had for the music of this.
Oh, yeah. That was.
And it's quite a story. I really kind of wanted you know, that Star Trek-y music that I, you know, was back in the 60s, and they had such great posers back then. And, you know, even working, you know, Fred Steiner and, you know, I mean, obviously Gerald Fried, who ended up doing our score. Gerald is actually the last living composer of original Star Trek. And, I didn't know how to find him or approach him. He didn't have any representation. And I got on the internet and I kept searching, and I finally figured out where he was. He was out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And so I sent him an email one night, and I wasn't really expecting to hear back quite so quick. I was saying, you know, Gerald, you know, this is who I am, and, you know, we've got this movie. We're hoping to do like a Star Trek-type score with it. And, you know, would you be – because I really didn't know. I knew that he was 88 years old at that time. I think he's like 91 or 2 now. But I said, you know, would you have interest in doing this? And I got a response from that email, I think within 3 or 4 hours, and said, hell yes, I want to do this. And so we drove out to Santa Fe. I actually had just was getting over pneumonia.
So I drove the whole way. That was the longest I ever drove. But we were like, oh, we got to get to Gerald Fried. We got to get to him.
And
we were really excited. So
we met. We get into Santa Fe, and we met him at a little restaurant. And this guy is just spry as hell.
Oh my gosh!
And he's just he's really a delightful guy. And to know Gerald is to love him.
Yes.
And he was driving this little Mustang.
Yes.
Convertible.
It was a Mustang convertible, and he's like, follow me. So he pops into his car, and I don't mean he just gets in. He pops into his car. He says, follow me. Doesn't even wait for us to get in the car, and takes off. And we're like chasing him down the street. We're like, oh my God, what's wrong with him? I mean, I'm like, dude, slow down, please, right? And then he's just like, oh, and we get into his house, and you know, he's just showing us all of his books and records, and he's just a neat guy. I'm so glad that he became our composer.
Yeah, he was telling me that the song that he's most known for in Star Trek is the fight music from Amok Time. And he told me, he says, that one score paid for his house. And so I said, that's really interesting. I said, what we would like to do is to maybe you could do that same score, but in a different way. Because obviously you can't impinge on somebody's intellectual property, and that's owned by Paramount.
Right.
So we changed it up a bit, and what he ended up doing was he added a bass harmonica to it. And this bass harmonica, it sounded pretty funny, you know, because every time that the plants would show up, he'd hit the bass harmonica
cool.
with
yeah.
it. So it was very funny. And so we have that our version of that song is during our boxing match.
Yeah, and we were able to hire a live 29-piece orchestra to actually perform and play the music. And that was...
Wow.
That you know, people say, oh, you know, your dreams come true. I say, like, most of the things I do are more goals. But when I heard that music, that was a real dream come true. I mean, to me, that was the best part of the film. It was the most exciting part of the film was the music. And just seeing all the instruments and, you know, there's links on YouTube of our experience there and, you know, all of the different musicians and... It was just really, really beautiful, you know. And then, you know, there's so much canned music nowadays that we never really thought that we would have that type of experience with our first film.
Yeah. Tell them about the time that he was laying on the ground.
Oh, you want me to tell her about that? Okay, Cheryl, you want me to tell you? Okay, I'll tell you something that happened, okay? Okay, so we're working, and it's a hard work. It's still hard work. You know, I was producing the whole thing and everything, and we're handling everything just as we would actors coming in and crew coming in and out. And there's all these musicians here. We take a break. And I go out and I'm talking to some of the musicians. They're having lunch. And then a couple of the investors and one of the granddaughters who's actually in the movie singing a song, comes to me and like, Angelique, we have to tell you something. I'm like, what's wrong? And they're like, the composer. I'm like, the composer what? Angelique, you just, and I'm like, okay, so I stopped listening to him because they couldn't get it out. And I go into the actual room where we were recording, and he was laying on the ground on the composer's podium. He was just laying there, and it didn't look like he was breathing. I just about had a heart attack. I was like, oh, my God. And we really didn't know what to do. We were like, is he breathing or is he not breathing? What's going on? And so finally, I forgot how we found out that he was breathing.
He finally got up.
That's what it was. He finally got up, and we were just freaked out. And we tell him, and he's like, oh, I take a afternoon nap every day. Oh, great. Great. Jerry, did you want to tell us that on the ground? Yeah. So he's such a kick up. He's had more energy than any of the actors and any of the musicians and anybody. And also, what was that? We got locked in when we were recording because there was a shooter. There was an active shooter while we were recording. So we actually got locked into the facility we were recording at. That's a whole other story.
That was the University of New Mexico.
Yeah. So.
But yeah, he's now I think 92 or
he's 92.
Going to be 92.
Yeah.
And he was telling me the other day. He says, "Yeah, I'm ready to do your next film." And okay. I mean, I'll definitely give him a call.
That's right.
Yeah. So yeah, he's writing his own script. He's looking to do his own story.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of these people that we met, a lot of the people that, you know, a lot of these actors had not worked in a long time, and they got like renewed visibility and renewed energy from this project. And, you know, I think that's kind of a neat thing because a lot of these people are very, very talented you know, And it's just because they're 70, 80 years old doesn't mean that they can't act.
Yeah, they're extremely talented. We were lucky to get them, that they said yes to us. Lucky. I wish we could have used them more. You know, we had such a film that was so much like a cameo. It was really a film of cameos, except
right.
for a few of the lead people. I wish we could have used some of these actors way more, but you know, next film. Our next film is not a Star Trek film. But there's still places you can put people and it'll be pretty amazing.
Well, you know what I think you two should do? I think that you should collaborate on doing like say a coffee table. Well, that's what they used to call them, the coffee table books, an unbelievable companion. And then you can tell all these different stories and like what you've just been telling and some more of the stories and then throw some pictures in there and sell that as a book. I think it would sell.
That's
and
a great
I think
idea.
It would be really interesting.
I think, I don't
that's
know.
That's a great idea, Cheryl.
I mean, I have to say, Angelique was kind of crazy about getting so many pictures, so many photos from the set and behind the scenes.
I was crazy?
Well, no, just, you know, you wanted it, you know, and we have, I think it's like 14,000 photos.
No, I didn't want it. We needed a set photographer, and we had people asking for those photos. Remember, StarTrek.com was on my ASS, being like, do you have the photos yet? Remember?
Yeah,
that's you know, we had people who wanted these photos, and I'm like, once I finished doing a day, they were like, okay, Angelique, do you have the photos? And I'm like, and so I basically have to go through almost 1,800 photos in one night and choose the top five best.
Yeah.
So that was crazy. Yeah, it wasn't like I was too tired to want it.
There were times when we had like three set photographers, four set photographers. I remember one time there was like four or five Star Trek actors all standing in a circle, and we were out in Malibu shooting, and one of the set photographers was taking pictures of the ocean, and I'm like, you know, you might want to turn around. There it is. There's the picture right there. But you know, we had I think what was it, 14,000 photos or.
In the end, we had about 14,000 photos, and that came from about 25 days of shooting this film. So, yeah. And you know, and nowadays, if you don't have a picture, I guess people think you didn't do it. It's not real. You didn't just spend all that money and spend all that time and get no sleep and be so tired you can't eat. That was an interesting time, eating.
One thing that we did, we branded ourselves with making sure that we had the absolute best food for the cast and crew. I mean, we went out of our way to make sure that they were fed well. No, there wasn't any Taco Bell or KFC on our set. So we,
and in turn, our we treated people different. That's like a huge thing for me is like, you know, I don't want anyone on my set who's not having a good time or not enjoying themselves or not feeling special. And, you know, we've worked, you know, we're older and we've gone through so many things. So we were really, really serious about treating people right and making sure they had great experiences. Michael Dorn actually told me when we took him to his green room, because he didn't think that this would really happen, but it did. But when I took him to his green room and I said, oh, here it is. I hope you like it. And he's like, Angelique, are you kidding? This is the nicest green room I've ever seen in my life. And I said, but you work for Paramount. And he's like, yeah, you don't understand. And I'm like, really? I just thought, you know, their level of who they were and are into Star Trek, that they have fabulous or fabulosity or whatever you want to call it. But we just wanted to treat people right. So we did that. We feel that we did that. And we're lucky that people worked with us and kept working with us, and we always will be. It's the crew that I hope to always use is the people that have worked with us and bring on any new people who want to help. So, you know.
And Angelique just did a fabulous job with producing this film.
Thank you.
I mean,
Steve.
She did the work of 10 people, and it was really something because everybody on that set respected her and was looking to her at every second. You know, they knew that Angelique had everyone's back, and she's a fabulous, fabulous producer because she knows how to delegate and knows how to deal with detail. There's so much of producing a film has to do with the detail and making sure that you've got every last little contingency thought through. What are the things that can go wrong and make sure that they don't. And, you know, if you try to produce by the seat of your pants, it'll never work. So, you know, she really had that nailed down, and everyone knew that she was the boss on set.
Oh, well, thank you. And Steve was an amazing director on set too. I have to give him his props too, because, you know, some of the actors are used to some directors, not all, who are mean or angry. And Steve was never like that. He didn't yell. He didn't have fits or anything. He just got his shots, and he didn't take too many takes either. So, you know, I have to give it to Steve too. And as many times as we brought in new actors, Steve rewrote things for them to do. Like Michael Madsen, he was living next door to a property we were filming at Malibu. And that day we were filming Armin Shimerman, Jeffrey Combs, John Billingsley, Dina Meyer, Livia Dabo, and Julie Warner. And we knew Michael Madsen lived next door, and we were making a lot of noise. And then all of a sudden, we see this like dark looming figure coming, looking over the balcony in his house. And I just thought, oh great, Michael Madsen's going to come over here and, you know, do a Michael Madsen on us. And he didn't, thank God. But the next day, which was really cool, after all the cleaning up, because after production day, it's not like all, you know, sweet and beautiful. I mean, you have to clean, and leave the house as the way you got it, including, and I just want to share this because it's real. Actually cleaning the driveway from car stain oil. The kind of work that I do. I don't just produce the film and cast people and raise money. Me and my play brother, Levi Alexander, who's also a co-producer in this film, were on a driveway that went downhill and curved, literally hand cleaning oil spots off of a driveway with toothbrushes. I mean, that's how deep it gets. So anyway, that same day, later on, the owner of the house calls me and says that Michael Madsen wanted to talk to us because he really loves Star Trek and, you know, can he be in the film? He wanted to be in the film. And I was like, well, yeah. So I call him up. He gives me his number, and I call him up, talk to him, and he says, yes, I really want to be in the film. And I'm like, okay, this is so wonderful. And Steve wrote in a role, and it was very interesting. It was very auspicious because Steve had mentioned the president in his script, but we didn't have a president. So Michael Madsen became President Ben Dover. And that's how it worked. Yeah, it's Ben Dover. And then what's the other? Russell Sprout?
No, Neil Down.
Oh, then Neil Down and see the press secretary. I forgot. The defense secretary is Neil Down.
So Neil Down and Ben Dover.
And then his daughter's name, which is played by Jasmine Anthony, who is also in Star Trek when she's a little girl. Her name in our film is Eileen Dover, like Eileen Dover. And then Barb Armstrong.
You guys got some really great names for these characters. I know I was looking at a lot of them. I'm like, I was laughing just at their names.
Thank you.
We have a lot of Star Trek Easter eggs in this film. And
It's about 60.
Yeah.
We
really went out of our way both visually and orally to kind of put these Easter eggs in and just let people, you know, kind of like go through it and get where, you know, where certain things are and what they came from, that sort of thing. So, there was a lot of little things that are in the film that people probably wouldn't get unless they watch it more than once. A lot of things just go by so quick
right.
that you know, they don't really get it or don't really understand. But
sorry, that's Augie breathing hard in the phone. Sorry.
Oh no, that was me.
See, you can't take him anywhere, Cheryl. See. Now you know why you don't have a Facebook page. <That's crazy.
laughs> Nobody would want my Facebook page.
Oh, God.
Nobody.
Oh yes, they'd be laughing, but crazy too.
So, no, it's
okay. Okay, I'm gonna have to take the dogs out because they're looking at me.
Yeah, we. Oh. It's.
Okay.
Yeah, they. They're just. They're. They're.
Come the heat of the kitchen.
No, that's all right. But we'll
okay.
continue as we take them out. It was about 60 Easter eggs. And I think when we were putting the when we had the we had a like the inaugural showing of this film back on August the 1st, and we put together a list of all of the Easter eggs, and so we'll probably
put all of that on the DVD when we finally release a DVD of this. But you know, it was we had 7 hours of talking about
seven
the
hours.
Angelique and I were on for 7 hours live talking to the actors.
5 minute break.
And so I guess, and all of that was recorded. So I guess what we'll do is we'll put that on as an addition to the film, and you know, as one of the things on the DVD. So.
And we know we only have a few more minutes. It looks like it's 6:14, so we don't want to jack up your time.
There's like 13 minutes. I mean, that's why I put it at an hour and a half, because Blog Talk Radio will cut you off in the middle of a sentence. And I thought, well, you know, with both of you being on, I wanted to make sure that you both got a chance to talk. And so I thought, well, I'll just put an extra half hour on there. So we still got like 13 minutes.
Can I ask you a question, Cheryl?
Go ahead.
I've never asked you, where are you from? Like, where were you born?
Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where I'm living now. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
I know we're on different time zones, but I didn't know exactly where you were.
Yeah, it's a nice, sort of nice town. I mean, you know, there's crime, but there's crime everywhere. So, but it's not a lot of crime, and where I live, it's a nice place. It's pretty quiet here, considering that it's a pretty big complex. So I live in a townhouse, and there's lots of townhouses here, and it's actually quiet most of the time. I mean, there's not like horns blaring and music blasting. That's not to say that it never happens, but it's not a constant thing. You didn't ask me about that, but I just thought I'd throw that in.
No, that's the important stuff, is getting some peace. We live in Ventura County, so we're still in California.
So one thing that I wanted to ask you about, you know, both of you, because Unbelievable was the first feature film from your Archangel Films.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, that's true.
And okay, so the name, one thing I was curious about, the name Archangel Films, did that come from your novels, the Archangels?
Yeah. I just said, you know, I mean, because I knew that I would eventually do the movies, I just said, you know, it's a good name, Archangel Films. And so we decided that, you know, we would name the production company that. But I know that Angelique has got some thoughts about, especially what we've been through with distribution. She's actually got some, I think, plans of maybe actually becoming a distributor at some point in time. You know, it's the school of hard knocks. You know, I mean, you learn all sorts of things about how not to make a movie, and then you can make one. Because you now know all the ways that you can't do it. So, you know, and you can't just, you know, go to a school or whatever to learn it. You just have to do it. And that's kind of like what it is in life too. I mean, you know, it's, people can tell you, oh, you should do this or you should do that. But I mean, until you've done it, you haven't really done it. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, you know, who knows, we may end up distributing. So, I mean, I feel like we're distributing Unbelievable, you know, right now. But, we're going to do some exciting things in the future, and we'll see how it goes. And Angelique has got some ideas for different companies, and I have ideas for different companies, and
So we'll.
Yeah, they're a little more than ideas. They're actually in process.
In process.
That's what he's talking about.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, kind of wrapped. Kind of, there's a wrap on some of that. We can't really go into it too deeply, but you know, it's things that
the world
are going to be impactful to the world, and you know, so.
So the DVD that you're eventually going to have, do you have like any kind of a rough idea of when it might be happening? It's mainly for the listeners.
Yeah. Well, we just went to cable on demand, and then the next step after that would be streaming VOD, which is like Netflix, Hulu, that type of thing. And then after that, there's pay cable, like HBO and Showtime, and then there's basic cable, and then there's what's known as AVOD, advertiser VOD, like Tubi. And then at that point, it would go to DVD. So it really depends on how quickly we go through those other platforms. But I would think, you know, maybe late April, early May, something like that.
Yeah, but for now, if people who want to watch the film can watch it on Spectrum, Comcast, Amazon, Vudu, possibly the Dish Network, but they can at least see it on cable too, you know, right before Christmas, or as a little Christmas movie. It's a Christmas weed movie, and we're not even marijuana smokers, but it's one of those movies where we just don't take ourselves seriously. It's just something for people to laugh at, get their minds off of COVID. And
yeah, I've told everybody, leave your brain at the door before you see this thing.
Yeah, we're not trying to win an Oscar here. You gotta tell them.
There's a scene in the movie that is like a takeoff of the Academy Awards, and I thought it would be funny to do that because this movie would never ever ever win an Academy Award, and so we'll just do that in the film. Well, and I said, and no one would ever make a mistake on the final reading of the winner of the best picture. So I said, you know, I'm obviously safe here. I mean, this would never happen in real life. And no sooner had we had shot the thing and it was all done than it actually happened in real life. And they had that one Oscar thing that they all got. I forgot which one
it was.
It was for a certain film, and then they said, no, it's this film.
And they
were like looking at the envelopes, and they said, what happened here?
That was.
And I, Angelique was on the treadmill, I think.
Yes, and all I hear is this
I'm
scream.
Yelling at her. I said, you are not going to believe this. I said, they actually did it. And he says, what? He says, they messed up on the Academy Awards. And they called one film for the best picture, and it's something else. And I said, they've got a major Chernobyl event here. And I said, I can't believe that this happened.
So people will think we copied that, and we totally didn't. We had filmed that, I don't know how many months, was it a year and a half or just months?
Yeah,
a year and a half beforehand.
It's like prescient. You know, I just couldn't believe that, oh, my God, I mean, they actually did it. So I thought I was safe, you know, like,
no,
this
safe.
Is something that's completely unbelievable. No. This would never have happened. And then they go ahead and they do it. So it was like, you know, I tell everybody, I said, the name of the film is Unbelievable with 5 exclamation points. I mean, what do you expect? And I kind of thought that the title would kind of give it away, you know.
Anyway.
So,
Yeah.
But anyway,
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh, well, no, I was just, you know, saying that there were all sorts of things in here that were just kind of, you know, it was like meant to be type of stuff.
that we just we had no idea that it was going to happen, but it was for the best.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I had asked about the DVD, of course, is because of all the extra stuff that gets put on it, because you had even mentioned some of the extra stuff that you were going to put on the DVD. And, excuse me, and I am in no way saying, oh, just wait for the DVD. No, see it now, however you can see it, and then also get the DVD. Because I know I want the DVD, but I also don't want to wait for the DVD before I see it.
Yeah, no, it's. I'm sure that there are going to be plenty of people that once they see it, they will want the DVD because, I said, so much of this goes so quickly, and you will probably miss half of the jokes because if you're not paying attention, it's going to go by very quick. So, we'll see how it goes. But I would think maybe May timeframe next year. That would probably be fairly close to when we would be releasing it.
Oh, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
We got like 3.5 minutes left now, and so usually at the end, I just ask the guests or guests in this case. How they would like people to get in contact with them if they want people to get in contact. And I always say if now because I actually had a guest that when I said that to him, he said, I don't want people to contact me at all. And at first I thought he was joking, but no, he was very serious. He didn't want people to contact him. And I said, that's fine. Everybody's got their own thing. So I make sure I say now, if you want to be contacted, let people know how they can contact you. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, we can be contacted on our website. It's archangelfilmsla.com. We can also be contacted on Facebook. It's official, Unbelievable the Movie. We can also be contacted on Instagram, which is at Unbelievable, M as in Mary, V as in Victor, Unbelievable MV. I can be contacted at Angelique Fawcett on Instagram. That's Angelique with a Q-U-E and then Fawcett with a C-E-T-T-E. And that's it, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not on the social media. I'm a little too old to be into that kind of stuff. I will say that anything that gets to Angelique will get to me.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
But I took a little bit of exception to what you said because I'm 60, which is considered old in some circles, and I love social media.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I got on it, I'd probably get addicted to it, but I haven't done it yet.
A lot of people would get told off, I'll tell you that. But it would be like he would have fun with it. It would be just fun for him, like real fun. I mean, oh my gosh, I'm open to him being on it, but you know, he doesn't want to be.
Yeah.
It would be very funny. I could become close to the sponsors and need to put on there.
Okay, there's like a minute left. I didn't mean to cut anybody off. But if either one of you or both of you want to say something in closing, this would be the time to do it.
Okay, I just want to say thank you, Cheryl. We love you, and thank you for supporting our film and going out and promoting it. We really appreciate it because you didn't have to. And I'm just so glad that we met and just glad to know you. And thank you for this time. And that's what I want to say. And to everyone else who watches the film, thank you so much for your support. Thank you for supporting independent filmmakers. We put a lot of hard work into it. So hopefully it makes a few people laugh.
Yeah. And I would just like to say those comments as well. But I think that the world takes itself far too seriously, And I think that we just need to just sometimes just, you know, let your hair down and just, you know, get excited for something like when we were excited when we were kids and we were, you know, we would watch a show that just made no sense at all, but it just, it was entertaining. And that's what Unbelievable is. I mean, it's just a kind of a throwback to a simpler era that, you know, we don't seem to have anymore. It's everything has to be so serious. And, you know, we just don't need that anymore.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And I'm going to have to cut it off here because we will get cut off eventually.
Okay. Bye.
So my guest, I love you guys too. I want to tell you that. But my guests have been Angelique Fossette and Stephen Fossette. I want you both to stay safe and keep your fur babies safe and have a good night. And thank you very much for being on the show again. And goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Good night. Good night.